MechCast, Monday, October 8th, 2018. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back. Happy to be back with you after a somewhat unplanned hiatus. Yeah, life, you know, sometimes you just need a break. And I had some things going on, needed a little break. Hopefully you got my last message that this show was going to be a little bit delayed, but here we are now. And as promised, boy, howdy, do we got lots of things to talk about. Lots of things to go over. We're going to be talking about a couple gates and really how they're not really issues. You know, those gates that anytime a new device comes out, it seems like some in the media like to perpetuate that there's problems where there maybe aren't really problems. So we're going to talk about that with the iPhone XS, XS Max, a little camera issue going on along with some other things. There are some actual legitimate bugs and issues that some people have run into. We'll talk about those a little bit, make sure that you're not suffering from any of them, or if you are, that you're aware of them and maybe have a workaround. Apple launching student IDs support for Wallet. We'll get into that a little bit. That's a quickie. And then when's Apple's next event? It could be happening sometime soon. We'll talk about theories as to what might be announced and when we might have those announcements. Then we got to talk a little bit about some Chinese spying and chips. You may have heard about that and what's going on there. And then MacBook Pro and iMac Pro repairs. There's a little news about that. And then, of course, we have your feedback. Actually, a lot of feedback this time around. Got a number of questions from the community that we're going to try and dive into. Oh, and I'm also going to talk to you about upgrading my operating system on my Mac. Yes, it's finally happened. If you've been listening to the show for a long time, you know, it's something that I put off and probably put off too long. So we'll talk about that. I'll talk about my impressions with macOS Mojave. We've got some Mojave tips to get into. We're going to talk a lot about two-factor authentication and then some general questions, one regarding Apple Watch and charging stands, and then also messages in the cloud. That'll round out this episode of the MacCast. So I don't want to delay any bit because we do have a number of things to talk about. So we'll jump right in to this whole iPhone XS, XS Max camera debate. And I'll start off by saying that the new cameras in the XS and XS Max, I have a XS, it's the same camera system, but the new camera system is amazing, in my opinion. I am absolutely loving it, and I don't regret doing the upgrade, because the number one reason I did want to get my hands on an iPhone XS after the announcement, as you probably heard me say, was that I felt there was enough in the camera system to warrant maybe having an upgrade and to be able to answer questions from the community, because I know a number of you really care about the iPhone camera. It's kind of, I think it's become the kind of defining feature of a smartphone these days, because they're so feature rich at this point, there's not a lot you can add. But anytime there's camera improvements, I think that is a good thing for a lot of people and something they really enjoy, because we take a lot of photos with our smartphones. And I say camera system because really, as Apple pointed out in the keynote, a lot of the improvements are in the software. What Apple is calling computational photography. They've sort of coined that as a marketing term, basically just meaning, you know, doing real-time live image processing using software in conjunction, as Apple does, with the hardware. So a lot of the improvements in the neural engine and the image signal processor and the A12 Bionic, all those things combining together to give you better photography. And I have to say, almost universally, within the community, the iPhone XS and XS Max cameras are being highly praised. As a matter of fact, DxO Mark gave the iPhone XS Max camera, and again, remember, it's the same camera in the XS, so when we're saying XS Max or XS camera, same camera system, DxO gave it its second highest score of any smartphone camera, just behind the Huawei P20 Pro. And I think that's a triple lens system. Remember, the one in the iPhone is a dual lens camera system. And they said that the XS Max has, quote, excellent photo and video quality and bright light with a very wide dynamic range and good detail. They did note, and I've noted this myself, that in low light it tends to be a little bit more noisy, and that's going to make some sense when we get into the next part of this story. But universally, you know, everybody's saying it's an amazing camera system. It's really being driven by a lot of those computational photography features, things like the smart HDR and the depth of field. So, you know, if you're reading around, people are saying it's a really good camera system. But some of that new computational stuff is actually causing some reviewers to go out and spread a little bit of FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. I think this all started with an Unbox Therapy video on YouTube, and it started being called, I think, Smoothgate or Selfiegate or Beautygate, I think, was another term that was thrown out of it. It basically, this allegation that Apple, with the iPhone XS and XS Max, is applying a quote-unquote beauty filter or a skin smoothing filter to, in this case, the TrueDepth camera, the selfie camera. And it turns out that's not at all what's going on. Apple is not applying any smoothing filters. It is something to do with the technology itself, what Apple is doing with the camera system, some changes and tweaks that they made in terms of shutter speed and stuff like that. And all of this was brought to light by the developer, Sebastian DeWith of Halide, which is a great third-party app for camera app for iOS, and he was able to debunk a lot of this FUD in a well-thought-out article on Medium. I'll try to have a link to that in the show notes at mattcast.com. You really should read through the whole thing because it goes through and explains a lot of stuff. And the reason they were digging in is because they make a raw photography app, and they were noticing some of these changes, and it was actually impacting the quality of the raw images coming out of the phone. And even though the raw images aren't using the computational photography stuff, there were some other tweaks that Apple made that go along with that system that were causing issues. And what they discovered is that because of some of the tweaks, Apple is using much more aggressive noise reduction in the camera system. And also, with how Smart HDR works, the merging of a bunch of different exposures, it tends to eliminate the sharpness in light and dark contrast. So that sort of expanding, that HDR expansion that they're doing, is getting rid of a lot of the contrast. That, coupled with some aggressive noise reduction, means that you're getting a general smoothing of textures across the board. So not just facial textures, but things like wood grains, or I've noticed it particularly in the edges of leaves and foliage and stuff like that. What I tend to call the almost watercolor effect that you get in the background. And it's all coming through with noise reduction. And the reason Apple is applying more aggressive noise reduction with the new camera system is because the new cameras are preferring a faster shutter speed and a higher ISO setting when they're taking their pictures. And this is all to improve the light capture, especially in low light, because a lot of people, when they take photos, they're not thinking about lighting. They want the camera to function broadly in the widest range of lighting. And most of the time, if you think about how we take photos, we're not always taking photos in bright light. We're doing them indoors. We're doing them in low light. And so Apple is choosing to make a compromise. And to compensate for that, they've tweaked the camera system to use a faster shutter speed and a higher ISO. But the problem with that is that means more noise. And because there's more noise, then Apple has also tweaked the software to do heavier noise reduction. And that heavier noise reduction is resulting in this smoothing or loss of detail. That, coupled with, again, sort of how Smart HDR works in terms of adjusting the exposures, right? It's going to bring out more detail in the darks and avoid blowing out highlights and stuff like that. But because of that merging, that's also reducing the level of contrast. So you're getting less contrasty images, but across the board, what looks like to most people, better images. And the problem here for RAW shooters, people who like to shoot RAW, is, and this is what the folks over at Halide discovered, was that that means RAW photos aren't doing the noise reduction, but they're doing the other things in terms of the shutter speed and the ISO. So they were noticing that they were getting overexposed and noisy images as RAW. They did not look very good, and that meant you really needed to shoot manually and sort of underexpose your photos to avoid possible clipping in your RAW photos on the iPhone XS or XS Max. And so I'm bringing this up because if you are a type of person, you like to shoot RAW, then you want to be aware of this, because you're going to either have to get a third-party app that's compensating for this. And as a matter of fact, Halide just launched a new version of their application with what they're calling Smart RAW that kind of takes some of these computational adjustments into play for shooting RAW photography. So if you do shoot RAW, you might want to look into that application. But if you're not doing that, then you're going to need to sort of adjust these things. So that's what's going on here. Apple is you know, not doing smoothing to give you better sort of beauty photography. They're doing smoothing to reduce noise because of some of the other camera tweaks that they make. Now, the debate and the argument that you could have that's not FUD, in my opinion, is what is the right choice? You know, are these changes the kinds of changes Apple should have made? And we had a debate about this a little bit on the Mac show this week. So if you missed that episode, we actually talked at length about this, because Ewan Rankin's a professional photographer, and he has a very strong opinion about this stuff that is in contradiction. And I think there's a lot of photographers like him out there that are in contradiction with Apple's choice to make the adjustments that they made. You know, he noted that a lot of the images that were coming off of the iPhone XS, XS Max camera are actually underexposed, and they have to be adjusted for exposure. And that's because of the tweaks that Apple is making in software. And are they the right choices? You know, the loss of contrast, I received an email from a listener who was shooting some photos out here in California and trying to capture sunsets, and specifically noted that the images looked, I think he described it as almost washed out or loss of detail. And that loss of contrastiness, also a little bit of the underexposing. And so you'd have to go in afterwards and sort of tweak things. And this is all with the Smart HDR feature. So I think what it comes down to in this case is that if you don't like the changes that Apple made with Smart HDR, or you don't like the results that Smart HDR is giving you, one, you probably want to just turn that feature off. You can go back to, so if you preferred how the iPhone 8, 8 Plus, 7, you know, if you preferred Apple's old HDR, that still is available. If you turn off Smart HDR, you'll get the same HDR that you had before. So that's one way to get this. Or also use a third-party app where you can adjust more of the manual controls, things like the shutter speed and the ISO, and you probably want to then tweak those a little bit to get more of the photography results that you want. So there is kind of a way around this. The question becomes, will there be enough debate in the photography community for Apple to actually go in and tweak or change the software? And I guess that's the kind of good news about this, is that Apple can tweak the software in a future release, adjust it, and, you know, make it work differently if that's what they choose to do. But for right now, it's looking like, you know, they think they have some of the best photography straight, you know, point and shoot coming off of any smartphone camera, and they made those calls. And my thing on the Mac show was, I think Apple hires very smart photography people for their camera division, and I'm sure they thought long and hard about these decisions and ultimately decided that they think this is the best way to do things. If you don't agree with them, though, again, you can adjust your settings, or you can simply use a different camera app other than the built-in camera app to take your photos and get the results that you're looking for. So it's great that we have options. A few other things to note on the new phones. The iPhone XS Max also won DisplayMate's Best Smartphone Display Award. So once again, Apple is on top in terms of their OLED panel in the iPhone XS Max as being a gorgeous, great display. And I have heard from many of you who have the XS Max and really like that display. I'm not sure if there's many differences between the XS and the XS Max display. I think They're both gorgeous, both really great displays. And so that was kind of a nice accolade for the new phones to get. Consumer Reports also has done some testing on battery performance, and they seem to think that the battery is a little bit better than the iPhone X, just like Apple said it would be. They say the XS Max battery lasts about 30 minutes longer than an iPhone X, and the XS Max, you should get about 90 minutes longer. Now, it is worth noting that this report conflicts with some other testing on the iPhone XS, XS Max batteries done by Tom's Hardware. They showed that they were actually getting slightly reduced battery life. As a matter of fact, they noted that the iPhone XS got almost an hour less battery in their testing. I have to tell you, I haven't personally noticed much difference between my iPhone X and XS Max on daily usage, but I'm pretty good about throwing it on the charger when I get a chance to, so I don't try to run my phone all day without hooking up to a charger. I have been out and about for extended periods of time, and I'm not noticing the battery depleting more quickly or anything like that. There have been some sporadic reports that if you're using screen time, that some people are reporting the battery depleting quicker than normal. I'm using screen time, and I haven't noticed that. So I don't know what's really going on there. I think it's really hard to kind of troubleshoot or judge batteries because I think everybody's experience is different. I do know that, you know, all the classic things are true. Using GPS, being in a bad cell signal area, all those things can help, you know, can cause your battery to go down a little bit more quickly. So it's sometimes hard to tell what's factoring into some of these reports. But overall, it's looking like people are very happy with the iPhone XS, XS Max upgrades. As a matter of fact, so far, most analysts seem to indicate that there is strong demand for this year's iPhones. Piper Jaffray's latest survey showed that about 39% of U.S. iPhone owners are considering an upgrade to an iPhone XS or XS Max. Interestingly, though, they say that the split between, you know, within that 39% of which phones those folks might buy or upgrade to seems to be about a 50-50 split, with about half the people going for an iPhone XS, half going for a XS Max. That does seem to contradict another report from Ming-Chi Kuo, who claimed that the iPhone XS Max was outselling the XS by a factor of about 3 to 4 times. And I have to tell you, not scientific at all, but just in getting your emails, it seems like most folks in the MacCast community who are upgrading to this year's iPhones are opting for the XS Max and either a 256 gigabyte model or a 512. So you guys are going all in. You're going for the big bad boy. A lot of people really wanted the Face ID technology with the large screen, and almost universally, I'm hearing from those folks who have upgraded to the large 6.5-inch display that you absolutely love it. I think that's great. You know me, I'm not a big phone guy, so I stuck with the iPhone XS. I just can't do that large of a screen. But if you can and you love it, more power to you. And there's a lot of you who seem to really, really love that. So almost universally, folks are saying, yep, it's looking like this year's iPhones are going to be big winners in terms of Apple sales. Everybody except Rosenblatt Securities analyst Jun Zhang. He supposedly looked at recent weekend sales and came to a very different conclusion. He says, quote, "We continue to believe total iPhone XS and XS Max sales will be lower than total iPhone X sales over a 2-month period." It's worthy to note, though, that he was very down on iPhone X sales also and got those numbers wrong. So it's looking like, you know, what he looks at is the store inventory and sales and what he calls the production ramp, basically using wait times on pre-orders to try and figure out a measure of the overall demand. So he's looking at Apple's ability to over-deliver on lead times. So you order a phone, they say, oh, it's going to be 4 weeks from now, and you get it in 2 weeks. And so he's making and drawing the conclusion that that means that Apple has excess inventory in the pipeline that they weren't expecting, that they were expecting sales to be higher. Therefore, sales are down or not doing well. And that just is a weird way to kind of think about this stuff. So I think overall, iPhone XS sales, when Apple announces their quarterly numbers, our XS series sales, are going to be pretty high. The one area where the Rosenblatt securities analyst sort of agrees with Ming-Chi Kuo is that the iPhone XS Max is outselling the iPhone XS. As a matter of fact, he says, quote, we believe the XS Max, that XS Max sales are about 4 to 5 times iPhone X sales. Again, this was over a recent weekend. Look at recent sales over a weekend. So, you know, kind of a small time frame to be looking at. But again, overall, I think the iPhone XS Max right now is the hot seller. I do think that's all about to change because remember, the iPhone XR has not arrived yet. I think pre-orders are going up, is it next week or in a couple weeks? And then that will be shipping toward the end of the month. I think the iPhone XR is going to be a massive seller. I think there's going to be a lot of folks upgrading to that. And I did get a question this week from someone in the community about my thoughts on the iPhone XR as an upgrade to the iPhone X. And I talked about this a little bit on the MacCast when I was talking about, you know, whether I was going to upgrade and my finally upgrading to the iPhone XS. And I have to say, I think the iPhone XR is a massive upgrade for anybody who has a prior generation phone that includes the iPhone X. And again, I think it's because of the processor and the camera system. You know, you in essence with the iPhone XR have everything that is in the iPhone XS or XS Max with just a few minor exceptions. Probably the biggest one being the dual lens camera system. So you lose the telephoto lens. If that's a big important feature to you, then the iPhone XR is not for you. Of course, the LCD screen versus an OLED, but I kind of see that as a very, very minor difference. And the reason I say that is because Apple's LCDs are historically so good that they get very close to the levels of an OLED display. So I don't see that as a massive difference in the two. And then, of course, you have the cellular modem technology. It's using the same technology that's in the iPhone X, but I don't see that as a big deal either. So, you know, if you want the new processor, if you want the computational photography stuff, I think, you know, getting an iPhone XR and saving, you know, $250, that's a lot of change. You can almost plunk down that and get an Apple Watch in addition to your iPhone XR and be out the door for about the same price as you would for buying an iPhone XS. So I think it's a great deal. I think it's a great value. I think it's a great upgrade for a lot of folks. So if you're in the market for an iPhone upgrade and you felt like the XS, XS Max were a little too high on price, you know, consider the iPhone XR. Plus with the iPhone XR, you get those great colors. That's not an option you can get with any other iPhone. And that almost pushed me over the edge. I did really consider doing an upgrade from an iPhone X to an iPhone XR. So I'm excited to see these things hit the market and hear your thoughts and reviews of the iPhone XR. I'm going to be watching very closely, and I will be heading into an Apple store to check them out in person and give you my thoughts on a side-by-side impression of the iPhone XR and the iPhone XS. All right, coming out this week also, because the iPhone XS, XS Max, they've been out in the market for a little while, they've been in the hands of consumers, we are starting to get reports of a few sporadic issues here and there. This happens with any iPhone launch. I don't think there's anything systemic or concerning in these reports, but I do want to bring them up in case you are running into these issues. You know, hey, I'm not alone. Other people are having these issues. Maybe there's some workarounds and fixes. There's also potential for software patches coming out in the future. And as a matter of fact, Apple, I think just as I started to record this podcast, released iOS 12.1, which was out in beta. And it actually addresses the first issue that we're going to talk about. There was a report that some people were finding issues in direct charging of their iPhone XS, XS Max using the USB to Lightning cable. So you'd plug it in either into the wall or into your computer, and it would not start charging. You wouldn't get the ding. The charging icon wouldn't come on, and it didn't appear to be charging. and unplugging it and replugging it back in would sometimes fix it, but it sometimes wouldn't, and it just seemed to be stuck and would get in the cycle where it wouldn't charge. Rebooting would often bring it back, but again, you probably don't have to worry about it too much because it looks like Apple has a software patch in the 12.1 update, so if you have run into this issue, grab that update and you should be good to go. Again, time will only tell if it fixes it for everyone, but there does seem to be this little tiny issue. We've also been receiving reports or seeing reports from some customers experiencing LTE connectivity issues with the newly released iPhone XS and XS Max. According to reports, engineers are looking into this. They're asking some customers to install a baseband logger to track their cellular connections and report the data back to Apple. What's happening is there's small groups of users who have noticed fewer bars and poorer signal quality on the iPhone XS or XS Max compared to some of Apple's older devices, including the iPhone X, 8, 8 Plus, all of those. Many of the early complaints seem to be coming from Verizon users, so we don't know if this is simply a carrier issue or carrier specific. It doesn't appear to be. There are reports from some folks having issues on other carriers. Apple is using new Intel modems in these models, so it could be related to the software there. And once again, there does seem to be a possible fix in the iOS 12.1 update. There are some modem firmware updates in there, and that could, some of those tweaks could be there to specifically address some of these issues. I, again, haven't personally noticed this other than to say one day I did have an issue with my carrier, but I think in my case it was a local cell tower problem. I called in, they were going to send out an engineer and check some things out. I don't think it's specifically related to my iPhone XS because I haven't had problems in other areas. But again, if you've been running into data, slow data issues, connectivity issues, you're probably going to want to grab the iOS 12.1 update and see if that doesn't address your issues. If you continue to have problems, certainly contact Apple support. Maybe you can get in with their engineers and do some of this baseband testing and help them figure out the problem so they can software tweak it. Another issue that some folks seem to be having is with Bluetooth audio and their car's infotainment systems. This seems to be, you know, just one of those things. Bluetooth is always kind of wonky, right? That's one of the things that makes the AirPods, I think, so awesome and Apple's W1 chip so awesome is it addresses, I think, some of the failures of Bluetooth to be a little bit flaky and have a little bit of connectivity issues. You know, the new iPhones, they have support for Bluetooth 5. The specifications are always kind of changing and being tweaked, and there were some last minute kind of changes. And so some people are reporting that they're having trouble with their car's audio systems, specifically cars from Kia, Audi, Subaru, and Mercedes. So if you've had one of those models and you've run into Bluetooth connectivity audio issues, there are reports that deleting and repairing your iPhone can sometimes help, but that appears to maybe only be temporary, and then you lose connectivity again, and you kind of have to do it all over again. You know, I think all of us have been through the pains of Bluetooth. So when I was reading about this, I was like, yep, here we go again. You know, different cars, different brands from manufacturers having issues. One thing you might try, because again, your iPhone has the latest and greatest Bluetooth technology, you might try checking with your car's entertainment system software, firmware, and make sure that that is up to date. There are some reports that that can help, but oftentimes, you know, dealing with your car company, that can be, it can be hard to find those firmware updates, I think, or sometimes they're just not there. So I don't know what the solution is, but I just want to, again, let you know if you are running into problems, you're not alone. There are some people experiencing issues. And if you are having these issues, you're always welcome to email in. And if you know of fixes, if you've run into these problems and you have a fix for yours, for your system, please email in and let me know. Because that way, if someone else emails me and says, hey, you know, I have a Subaru, this isn't working, and you have a Subaru and you found a solution, I can pass that solution on to them and we can maybe give people in our community some help. But that's another issue. And then one other issue that cropped up this week, this one relating to the Apple Watch Series 4, seems to be a daylight savings time bug that hit some folks in Australia. The bug happened when Australia's clocks changed early Sunday morning. The rest of us in other regions, we have daylight savings time coming up later, but Australia, it already went into effect. And what happened was some Series 4 Apple Watches went into a reboot loop, and you apparently could not get out of that reboot loop, which would be very annoying and very frustrating, I can only imagine. Some theories surfaced as to why on Reddit, and it looked to be related to an issue with the new Infograph activity complication. So if you didn't have that watch face turned on and you weren't using the Infograph, the activity Infograph, you seem to be unaffected. But if you had that, you would get into this reboot loop, and you could fix it by switching to a different watch face. That would solve the problem. I would assume you'd probably have to do it from your iPhone, from the watch app. They didn't really describe how you could switch this over, because supposedly if you had the problem, your watch just was constantly rebooting and you really couldn't get in to access any of the controls. Maybe doing a remote reset or something like that could get you back to normal. But fortunately, it looked like the issue resolved itself after about 24 hours. So it was only on the day of the time change where this problem was happening. And like I said, it was exclusive to Australia, according to the report. But the U.S. and the U.K., we do have daylight savings time coming. In the U.S., it's going to be on November 4th. In the U.K., it's on October 28th. So hopefully Apple will figure out what was causing this problem and address the issue with a software update before other countries have to do the daylight savings time switch, and we won't run into this problem in other regions. But if you were in Australia and experienced that, sorry to hear about that. That would have been really, really frustrating. One of the things that Apple highlighted back at Worldwide Developer Conference in June was a number of the features in iOS 12 that were there to open up and expand the NFC capabilities and Apple Wallet capabilities that are in iOS 12. And one of those new features was the ability to have student IDs in your Apple Wallet. Well, it looks like now Apple is finally starting to roll that out at a few universities. They were going to do, I think, some early testing, kind of select universities were going to roll this out as a program. And now students at Duke University, the University of Alabama, and the University of Oklahoma can add their student IDs to their Apple Wallet. Boy, do I wish I had this when I was in college. This sounds so cool. And, you know, unfortunately, some of you who are at other universities are probably going, when are we going to get this? I really hope we get this. Basically, you can put your student ID in your Apple Wallet. That means it's then available to use from your iPhone or your Apple Watch using NFC, and it means that you can pay for your school services, you can unlock dorm room doors, and do all of that stuff after verifying with Touch ID or Face ID, all without having to carry around your student ID in your wallet or bring it out of your wallet, anything like that. And it just sounds like it would be an amazing experience. Anytime we have fewer cards that we have to carry around so we don't have wallet bloat, I think that is a good thing. I'm looking forward to the point when I can have my driver's license in my Apple Wallet. And Apple has reportedly been working on some of that technology. I don't know, you know, what states they're going to work with, but, you know, military IDs, state IDs, driver's licenses, I think we should have everything virtually in a, you know, digital wallet on our smartphone, and then we can just carry the smartphone around. It'll be amazing when we get to that day. But one step at a time, so it's looking like they're starting to roll this out to universities. Hopefully the program will be highly successful, and it does look like Apple is ready to expand to a few other universities here pretty quickly. Next on the list, reportedly, is Johns Hopkins University, Santa Clara University, and Temple University. They're supposedly going to add the capability by the end of this school year. No word on what other universities might roll out this program after that. But if you happen to be at one of the universities that did get support for student ID in your Apple Wallet, let us know how you're liking it. If it's working well, if there's good deployment on your campus, what's going on with this? Are you enjoying it? And I can't imagine if it's implemented well that you're not, but let us know how it's going out there. Shoot us some feedback. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Now I want you to think back to the lead up to Apple's September event and all of the rumors. I know there's lots of them. We talk about rumors here all the time on the MacCast, but you remember all the things that we were talking about leading up to that event? We had rumors about a number of things that Apple has not shown us yet. And historically, in the past, before last year, because it was skipped in 2017, Apple often held a September event for iPhone stuff, and then an October event, which was typically focused around the iPad and maybe some Mac announcements. And so we are this year still expecting those because we had heard iPad rumors and Mac rumors. So you might be asking yourself, well, Adam, when are we going to get to see that stuff? And there have been a number of sites looking into all of the past years and when we had an October event. One of the ones that I saw that I thought had the best analysis was Mac Rumors. They sort of broke down everything. And in looking at the dates, you know, they did note that Apple skipped the October event in 2015 and 2017. But historically, Apple has held the event either on a Tuesday or a Thursday in the fourth week of the month. Most recently, this would be 2016, it was held on a Thursday, but prior to that, it was held on Tuesdays. And so they're looking at the calendar, they're looking at the dates. That would put the date, if Apple does do it on a Thursday, at October 25th. We would then expect invites to go out a week before. Apple seems to only send them out 7 days in advance, much to the chagrin, I'm sure, of many folks who had to fly out to Cupertino last minute to get there. I'd welcome the opportunity to do that, though. I don't unfortunately get invites. Podcasters are generally not on the list. You generally need to be a print publication or a blogger for a very high profile technology site to get an invite. I guess they also, Apple really likes YouTubers as well. Some of the YouTube crowd does get invited to Apple's events. But as far as when it might happen, I'm in agreement with Mac Rumors. I do think the event will be held on Thursday, October 25th. I also do think Apple will hold an event this year. I think there's enough announcements that they're not just going to roll it out quietly. They have done that in the past, though, so I don't put it past them, but I say with 90% certainty that we're going to get an event on October 25th and invites will go out on the 18th. And so you're like, great, Adam, but what are we going to see at this event? Well, I have to tell you, there is strong rumors of new iPad Pros or iPad Pro updates. Of course, we're going to get all the things with better processors, better graphics engine. The big news here is that there's going to be a small bump in size on the 10.5-inch model. It's supposed to be an 11-inch version, and then an update to the 12.9-inch model, bringing in all of the design and features of the iPhone X, XS, XS Max. That means thinner bezels, edge-to-edge displays, no home button, the TrueDepth camera system, Face ID technology. And the big question is, what is the connector on the iPad going to be? We've heard rumors that Apple has been dabbling and thinking about moving from a Lightning connector to a USB-C connector. But we heard that about the iPhone, and it didn't happen there. I think it could happen on the iPad Pro first. And the reason I'm kind of feeling that is Apple has switched to USB-C in its notebook lineup, and I think the iPad seems like the next logical choice, right? It sort of sits between your iPhone and your Mac. And I think ultimately Apple does want to standardize on the USB-C connector. I think Lightning has had its time, has had its day, but with the features and the speed and the charging capabilities of USB-C, I think it makes sense to standardize on that connector. So I think there's good odds that Apple will release the iPad with a USB-C connector. Another big question is Apple going to move the smart connector? Because we've seen rumors about that. Of course, you're going to need, with the new sizes and the new form factors, probably new smart accessories, so they could do that. A lot of the rumors leading up to this were really weird, though, because that connector was on the back, and I just don't see how that would physically work. But I guess that could happen. But fully expecting that we'll see some new iPads, and that it will be mostly focused on the iPad. This event will be mostly about iPad. There could be a few Mac updates, though, as well, because we've been hearing rumors about an updated Mac Mini, maybe a Mac Mini Pro, and the Mac Mini is way overdue for some love. I would love to see Apple do something with the Mac Mini, and this seems like the right timing. Otherwise, I think if they don't do anything with the Mac Mini, that may say a lot as well. It may say that the Mac Mini is on the way out. And the other Mac update we might get is this possibly rumored less expensive MacBook, entry-level price point MacBook, maybe some MacBook spec bumps on the other models. And then we all are also hearing about the slight possibility of a spec bump to the iMac line. So Apple released the iMac Pro, but we haven't seen much with the iMac. I think the iMac line, it might not even be part of the announcement. So if Apple does update the iMacs, it would just simply be a spec bump that could happen after the event or just on the website or something like that. So I'm going to put my money on iPad Pro, possible new Mac Mini announcement, and possible MacBook announcement with a spec bump of the iMacs, and happening toward the end of October. There are a few wild cards that could be thrown in here. We have been hearing rumors about Apple considering a lower cost version of the HomePod. I'm going to say 100% no on that. I don't think that's happening. I think the HomePod, despite what some people in our community believe, I think it's selling very well from Apple's perspective, and I think it still has a lot of room for growth. And I think Apple won't expand the HomePod lineup until they've sort of saturated the market and gotten into the hands of everybody who wants a current version of the HomePod, a HomePod. And I think this holiday season, it's going to be high on the gift list for a lot of Apple and Mac nerds out there. A lot of you want HomePods and you don't have them yet. And I think you may be getting one for the holidays. And Apple knows this. So I don't think they want to dilute that lineup quite yet. Maybe early next year, probably more like mid to late next year, we might get a expansion of the HomePod lineup. AirPods, updated AirPods, maybe. I'm not putting much stock in this. I give it about a 10% chance that we've got some updated AirPods, but we have heard a few rumors about noise cancellation being added to AirPods, that sort of thing. So there could be an AirPod update. AirPod wireless charging case, I think that's very likely to happen. Apple could finally release that as an accessory upgrade, and they may talk about that a little bit. The one thing that is also a wild card in some people on some people's lists, the Air Power Mat or Air Power. Not a chance in Hades, folks. That product, in my opinion, is dead. And Apple is just hoping we will forget about it and believe that it never happened, that it never existed. I think it's vaporware, and I think it's never hitting the street, and I think Apple shall never speak of it again. So that's just my opinion, my thoughts on what we'll hear and see at the October event. If you have some of your own thoughts and opinions and theories, shoot us an email. Share your thoughts with us, maccast@gmail.com. So did the Chinese government put spy chips into Apple's iCloud servers? Not just Apple's, but also Amazon's. A Bloomberg piece published this week is causing a huge controversy. They are claiming that companies including Amazon and Apple found surveillance chips, Chinese surveillance chips in their server hardware that they purchased and contracted from a company called Supermicro. The piece even goes on to claim that they contacted the FBI and that the FBI is still conducting secretive investigations, and this is why these companies are denying and not wanting you to believe that these chips are in there. Oh, man, I don't even know where to start with this. Apple has come out very, very publicly and very, very, you know, vehemently, verbally, and denied these allegations. They almost seem to the point where they're actually, you know, pretty upset about it. And Apple typically, you know, if something's going on and they don't want to flat out deny it, they'll just not say anything. You know, they'll just historically stay quiet. So I'm kind of feeling like the fact that Apple is so verbally vehemently denying that this happened is a sign that, no, they did not find surveillance chips in their servers. They did not contact the FBI. You know, the claim was that Apple found these chips on motherboards back in 2015. Apple told Bloomberg specifically before they even published the piece that the claims were not true, and they told them that they were misinformed by their sources. Bloomberg, for whatever reason, chose not to believe Apple and go with their sources and run the piece anyway. After all of this sort of came out, Apple told CNBC that they only ever found an infected driver on a single Supermicro server, and that was only in their lab. And one of the things that Apple does, and one of the reasons they're being so adamant that this didn't happen, is they set up all their servers in labs. They run diagnostics and security. As you could imagine, Apple has to be super careful about this stuff. They did confirm they're getting hacked and attempts to be hacked all the time, and they're constantly having to stay diligent on this stuff, and they're super, super careful about it. And so they found some software on an infected driver in a server in the lab in 2015. I think not long after that, they canceled all of their contracts with Supermicro, supposedly over this issue. And this is a little bit about what was driving the Bloomberg piece. And I have a feeling why Bloomberg is tending to believe their sources. Who really knows, you know, from their perspective? But Apple going out of their way to really deny this. They also said that no one from Apple ever reached out to the FBI and that they had never heard from the FBI about an investigation into any of this, so they haven't been working with the FBI. And then later in the week, they also sent a letter to Congress where they reiterated that they found no evidence of microchip-based server tampering by Chinese agents on their servers. So, you know, Apple saying no. This is a he said, she said. You know, we'll never really know for sure. But I can't see any reason not to believe Apple on this. They've always been pretty open and upfront, and they believe in full disclosure when it comes to, and transparency when it comes to privacy issues and their customers and all of these things. I can't imagine why they would possibly need to deny this. I guess the allegation is that because there's ongoing, you know, potentially Homeland Security and government investigations going on here, that they can't, and they have to sort of deny this publicly and not let on. But I don't think that's what's going on here. I think if this had happened, if they had found these chips, they would be openly talking about it, explaining what went on and what resolutions they went through to do it. But I don't know. You know, we can all put our tinfoil hats on and have conspiracy theories. You're welcome to do that. I just am choosing not to buy into it in this case. But again, I'd love to know what you think. You know, is this going on? Is there a huge government conspiracy to cover all of this stuff up? And are Apple and Amazon all part of it? I don't know. I don't know. I really don't. I have no idea how we would know. I'm going to believe Apple on this one anyway. All right. Finally, in the news for this week, new MacBook Pro and iMac Pro systems with the T2 chips. It's looking like they might require some diagnostics tests after you have repairs done on them to continue to function. Mac Rumors acquired some internal repair documents from Apple that showed that after certain repairs, the iMac Pro or the 2018 MacBook Pro models may be required to pass a system diagnostic before becoming functional after doing repairs. In the case of the 2018 MacBook Pros, the requirement applies to repairs involving the display, the logic board, Touch ID, and the top case. For the iMac Pro, the requirement only applies to the logic board or flash storage repairs. And what this is it's a test suite that is part of Apple's service toolkit, which is only available to Apple stores and Apple authorized service providers. So the claim is that, hey, you do one of these repairs, you need to run these tests, otherwise the computer's not going to function. And the allegation and the concern here is that means that you could only ever have your Apple products, if you own an iMac Pro or a 2018 MacBook Pro, you could only ever have those serviced by an Apple store or an Apple authorized service provider. Now, I would argue those are the only places you want to have your repairs done. But, you know, they tend to be a little bit more expensive, and people like to save money and people like to have options. So there's this whole debate on right to repair and all of these sorts of things. And so the allegation is that this is a kill switch. Apple is deliberately putting this into play so that, you know, people who don't want to be part of the authorized service repair program, they can't fix machines, and Apple's monopolizing and locking them out of the repair market, and that they use things like this to facilitate that. I don't know that that's necessarily the case. What really looks like is happening here is that after certain parts are serviced, because these systems, specifically the iMac Pro and the 2018 MacBook Pro, have the T2 security chip, there's some integrations there, and you just need to run through some of these diagnostic tests to confirm that everything is working and the security is reset up in place. I would imagine this is more of an anti-tampering thing, right? So that you don't end up with Chinese surveillance chips inside your MacBook Pro because you bought some Chinese part that had that chip in it, and now it's doing strange things on your system. So you run it through the diagnostic tools from Apple. It makes sure that everything is copacetic and in place and the way it should be, and there's not anything funky going on. And then it's good to go. And Apple's document does seem to claim that failure to run these Apple diagnostics after these certain parts are replaced in a T2-equipped Mac would, quote, result in an inoperative system. All right. So that's what's going on. Good news is it looks like this requirement is not yet enabled, because the folks over at iFixit, they claim they were able to replace a display and a logic board in a 2018 MacBook Pro, not run these diagnostic tools, and it came out functioning totally fine. So even though it didn't pass the diagnostics because they didn't run them, the system was running just fine. So is this a future requirement? Is it something that Apple is going to turn on at some point? Maybe. Maybe they should. You know, in looking at it, it seems to make sense to me that this should be something. And to get the certification to become an Apple authorized service provider is not particularly cost prohibitive. You do have to take some testing. I think you have to pay a couple $100 and you're good to go. And then you can get access to the Apple service toolkit. And again, I think these are diagnostics tools that if you were taking your Mac to a repair shop, you would want them running anyway, because it's going to verify that you're not going to have a problem, especially if you later then go into an Apple authorized service provider or an Apple store and they start to question the parts or repairs that you had done because maybe they were shoddy workmanship or weren't done in a correct manner. You can maybe point back and say, no, you know, actually they ran the service diagnostics tools. It passed everything. And you could go back to that provider and say, hey, can you give me that report so I can verify? You know, I don't know. I'm not a repair technician. I could be just talking out of my backside. And if you know differently, I'd always love to hear from you. If you work in a shop that maybe doesn't want to deal with becoming Apple authorized, but you still want to service Macs and you do a good job, you know, let us know what you feel about this. I just don't buy into some of these conspiracy theories that Apple is trying to prevent, you know, the service and repair of their systems. I think ultimately what they care about is the quality of the repairs and making sure that things are done right and with the right components. And a lot of these diagnostic tools and procedures are in place to ensure that, so that the customer gets the best experience. I really think this is Apple looking out for the customer more than them trying to lock out other companies or cause you to pay more for repairs. But I'm willing to have the debate. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. When it comes to marketing your business, it's all about reaching the audience at the right time and connecting with them when your message will resonate the most. So if you want to target your customers where they are engaging every day and when they're ready to make a decision, LinkedIn can help you. When you advertise on LinkedIn, the world's largest professional network, you have the opportunity to build long-term relationships with your customers, relationships that can often translate into high-quality leads, website traffic, and higher brand awareness. So what's the first step? Well, talking to the right audience. And with a community of over 575 million professionals on LinkedIn, you have access to a diverse group of people searching for the things they need to grow professionally. LinkedIn has the marketing tools to help you target your customers with precision, down to things like their job title, company name, and industry. Better targeting equals a message your customers care about, which in turn leads to more trust built with your customers. In fact, 4 out of 5 customers who are on LinkedIn are decision makers at their companies. So that means you're building relationships that really matter. To redeem a free $100 LinkedIn ad credit and launch your first campaign, go to linkedin.com/Maccast. That's linkedin.com/MACCAST for your free $100 ad credit. Terms and conditions apply, and a huge thank you to LinkedIn Marketing Solutions for their support of the Maccast. I need to start off with a small technical correction for the last episode of the Maccast that I ran. Listener John wrote in to point out an error in some comments that I made regarding the new Apple Watch Series 4 and the ECG feature as it relates to the FDA clearance. And that word clearance is the key technical correction, because I believe in the episode that I claimed that the Apple Watch had FDA approval. And as John rightfully pointed out, there actually is a difference between clearance and approval. And what the Apple Watch actually has is a clearance. So what's the difference? That's exactly what I wondered. And luckily, John sent me a link to the FDA's FAQ, to their website. And it basically comes down to this. In order for medical devices to be legally marketed or sold in the United States, they do require that they are cleared or approved by the FDA. So you have to have one of those two things, either clearance or approval. But the clearance is much easier to get than the approval. And here's the difference. Cleared devices are the ones that the FDA has determined to be substantially equivalent to or similar to other legally marketed devices. So the requirement to get a clearance is, hey, you have to have something that is very similar or works just like or is equivalent substantially to something that already exists on the market that has an approval. So in the case of the Apple Watch, Apple just had to build a system that was equivalent to other ECGs that were on the market and already approved by the FDA. To get an approval, approved medical devices are those devices that the FDA has approved a pre-market approval or a PMA application for, or a humanitarian device exemption, HDE, application for. This review and approval process is for Class 3 medical devices, the ones that are the highest risk and involves a more rigorous review process. So there, it's much harder to get an approval than a clearance, and that is an important distinction. So I said the wrong thing by mistake. I didn't understand the difference, and huge thanks to John for educating us. I appreciate that, because we always want to be right here on the Maccast. So little correction for you to kick off the feedback part of the show. Next, I want to get into macOS upgrades, because we have a new version of macOS out, macOS Mojave. And so finally, for me, after a year, an extra year, 2 years, I guess, really, of being on macOS Sierra, I finally did an operating system upgrade. So I haven't upgraded my OS in 2 years. And you might be thinking, Adam, how did you do the Maccast without upgrading to High Sierra? I actually did upgrade a backup Mac, my MacBook Pro 2011 MacBook Air, excuse me. My 2011 MacBook Air was upgraded to macOS High Sierra. So I was able to do testing and play around with it there. But in my main production system, I kept putting it off and putting it off, to the point where we got to the new release, macOS Mojave, and I still hadn't upgraded to High Sierra. I guess there just wasn't enough features in there, and I wasn't really having... Well, I take that back. I was going to say I wasn't having trouble with my macOS High Sierra. I was actually having trouble with macOS High Sierra. Little quirky issues, little bothersome issues that I kind of felt were mostly caused by me not doing a clean install of macOS High Sierra. I had done over-the-top installs for a few years. I had a lot of cruft and clutter And because I do web development work, there's a lot of low-level stuff that I put on my system. I use something called Homebrew for installing Linux-based packages. I run Apache servers, and I run database servers, and I run all sorts of things under the hood in addition to macOS on my system. And a lot of that stuff is not very easy to sort of back up and restore. It's a long process to build all that back up. And I had known for years that I needed to do a clean install. I wasn't looking forward to the hassle of doing a clean install. And I also had active projects going on, just never had the time or never felt I had the time to do an upgrade and to do it properly. So that's what took me so long. Why did I do it now? Well, one, I had a little bit of time on my hands, and two, it just needed to be done. I couldn't go another year without upgrading to the latest version of a Mac operating system. I've got to be able to talk about it on the show. I want to be using it on a day-to-day basis. I want to be using the same stuff you're using so that, you know, when you email me a question, I can be informed and answer it properly and all that sort of stuff. So I did a clean install, and a lot of you, every time I do a clean install, I do get a lot of questions. I have a lot of people ask me, how do I do a clean install? What's the procedure? What's the process? I've covered it several times on the MacCast. There's great how-to articles. Just search for macOS clean install, and you can get great instructions online. So I'm not going to go into the full details here, but I'm going to give you the high-pass overview. Real quick overview of what I did, what I typically do when I'm doing a clean install, what I mean by it. And the first step in that is doing a backup, making sure that you have full backups, at least two separate full backups, because the minute that you erase your hard drive, and doing a clean install means you're going to erase your boot drive. If you only have a single backup, then at that moment, the moment you erase your internal boot drive, you don't have a backup anymore. So you want to have two backups in case something happens with one of those backups, right? That's the point of a backup. So two full backups. In my case, I have three full backups because I have a carbon copy cloner backup. You could also use a super duper, but a cloned backup. I have my Time Machine backup, and I also back up to the cloud using Backblaze. So I already had three active backups that were good to go. I did run the Time Machine and the carbon copy cloner right before I did my clean install, so I made sure I had current up-to-date backups of those. And also, this is a good tip, booted into my carbon copy cloner backup just to make sure that I had a bootable backup and that I could read the files off of it and everything was okay. Probably maybe even should have run a little disk utility on those backup drives just to make sure the drives were healthy. I didn't do that because, again, I had multiple backups. I also do, as you know, chronosync of certain critical files and documents, basically just every night, certain files and documents like all my MacCast audio files, all of my website project files and stuff like that, those get backed up to a couple of Drobos. So I have two Drobos in the house, goes over the network. One's direct connected, the other one's over the network. Double copies of all those critical folders and documents are also. So I really have, you know, for my main really critical stuff, like five backups. I know I'm crazy about backup, but you get the point. Have a backup before you do a clean install because there's erasing involved and you don't want to lose data. Then I went on the App Store. I downloaded but did not run the installer for macOS Mojave, and the reason you do that is that's going to give you a local copy of the installer, and I wanted to create a bootable USB key to install Mojave from, so I could boot from that USB key and then do a erase of the internal hard drive and a clean install. And again, there's instructions for this online. There's actually third-party applications you can get to help you out with this. The technique that I used was I actually went into the terminal, went into the install package for macOS 10.14, and that's what gets downloaded when you pull it down but don't run the installer from the Mac App Store. You can find that on your system. I think it just installs as an application in your applications folder. So you can find it there. You go in, you right-click or control-click on it, choose Show Package Contents, and then you can go in and find there's actually a Create Install Media application inside that installer. And so, again, there's instructions for this online. I use the ones at Ars Technica. I'll have a link to them in the show notes at maccast.com. But just know I created a bootable macOS Mojave install on a USB key. And I actually do this for every operating system. So I have a whole collection of these going all the way back to, I think, Lion. So I have a USB install for every operating system from Lion forward. And those are great. They've come in handy because I've had people who have older Macs. They're like, I need to install, you know, Mountain Lion. How do I do that? And I can say, you know what? I have a USB key that I can clone for you or give you a copy of, and you can do it from there. So those come in really handy. They're great for troubleshooting also, and just emergency boots and all that sort of stuff. So I would recommend building one of those. Once I did that, then it was a simple matter of booting into the USB key, opening up the disk utility, and then formatting, completely erasing my macOS Sierra install, and then quitting out of that and installing, running the macOS Mojave installer right from the USB key, and installed that right onto my main drive on my MacBook Pro. That took a little bit, but went perfectly smoothly. And then when I rebooted the system, I just simply started the process, you know, walked through the wizard of setting up a brand new Mac, which means creating my user account, also connecting to my Wi-Fi network, and then connecting to iCloud and iTunes. So once I've done that, and the machine is booted, that's going to resync things like all my iCloud stuff, like my contacts and my calendars, all those sorts of things. And that also then gives me access to the Mac App Store, and I can start to reinstall from scratch any applications that I need that were purchased from the Mac App Store. Another reason for doing this clean install was just to clean out my applications folder. I have a lot of things that I've built up over the years, stuff that I don't really use anymore, and so I wanted to clean install all my applications. I also did not use Migration Assistant to bring over my home folder. Although if you didn't need to do a full clean install, you could bring that stuff over. Typically what I do if I'm doing that is I only bring over my documents and those sorts of things. I don't bring back the applications, and you can do a custom migration if you want to do that. But this time I really wanted to do a fresh clean install, so I was doing everything from scratch. So I did hand copy over folders and files from my home folder, and where I grabbed these from was my Carbon Copy cloner disk. So I just connected my cloned backup directly to my fresh new macOS Mojave install, and then hand copied from my old home folder into my new home folder my documents folder, my downloads folder, my movies folder, my music folder, which includes my, or would typically include my iTunes music library, although in my case I had it on an external, my pictures folder, which very importantly included my photo library, brought all that stuff over by hand, my sites folder, basically everything in that home folder, just copied all those over directly, just through the Finder, nothing special, nothing fancy. Brought those all back over. Not bringing over, though, my library folder. I did not want that because that's going to have all of that cruft that I'm trying to get rid of. So did that. As I mentioned, my iTunes music library is already on an external drive, so that was simply a process of launching iTunes and then pointing it at my external library, letting that update. And then for Apple Music, turning on Apple Music, and then for my photo library, just opening up photos, it is pointed at the library that I copied over in the pictures folder, and that was all fine, and then I just had to re-enable iCloud Photo Library. The only disadvantage of that is it does have to do a re-indexing. It says, and this gets confusing, and I just want to point this out, it said for a few hours that it was like uploading or downloading images. It's not really downloading. What it's doing is it's comparing and indexing, deciding if it needs to download anything from your iCloud photo library, and then doing it. That process can be very slow. Another thing that happens when you're doing this is you do have to redo your Spotlight indexing. So Spotlight ran for a long time, so be ready to expect that. That can impact performance for a little bit. So you might have a little bit of a performance slowdown, but you know, just let that stuff run. It'll take a day or two, and then it will all smooth out. But copied all that stuff over. And then I started to install my critical applications. And for me, the very first critical application that I need to install is 1Password, because that has all of my account passwords and my software keys. And these days, you need that for resetting up applications in a lot of cases, for accessing my mail accounts, resetting up mail. And I did do that also. Like mail, I did not bring over all of my mail folders. I just reconnected to the IMAP servers and let it sync everything back down from my email accounts. I really did want a clean install. If you don't want to wait that long for that, you can go into your backups, into your old user folder, and grab all your mail files, those sorts of things, and you can kind of speed that process up. But once I had 1Password reinstalled, that meant I could start to reinstall my applications. Another one of the first ones that I reinstalled was SetApp, because I use several apps from the SetApp collection. And so by reinstalling that first, I could download things and install things like Bartender, Ulysses, Clean My Mac, all those utilities and great applications that I use from that package. So what was really nice about doing this clean upgrade, and it turned out it wasn't as complicated as I thought, was that so much stuff is now in the cloud or through single services like the App Store or SetApp, that sort of rebuilding all of those applications and files and stuff from scratch really was a lot less painful than it has been in the past. So started reinstalling all my applications. I started rebuilding my development environments, you know, reinstalled Homebrew and all of my MySQL databases, Apache configuration files. And I had, prior to doing the clean install, done manual backups of all that stuff. So I had that in a single location already on my old hard drive, so I could grab those. Did that, and that all went pretty smoothly. And then for applications, some of them I just wanted to run from scratch, let them rebuild their configuration and their preferences and stuff like that. I didn't mind that. There are, however, some critical applications where I need support and configuration files. And so for those applications, I did manually copy, again, items from the application support folder in my old library folder and from the preferences folder in my old library folder. So if you go into your home folder, into the library folder, there's a folder called application support. And any applications that need to put things into your, at the system level, basically will install folders there. And the folder is usually the application name, so they're usually pretty easy to locate. And also, any application preferences are going to be in the home folder, in the library folder, inside the preferences folder. And there, the names can sometimes be tricky to find because it's generally like a domain. So it'll be like com dot the software maker's name and then dot the application name. So like for Feeder, which is an RSS app that I use and rely on for the podcast, it's created by Reinvented Software. So com.reinventedsoftware.feeder.plist is the preferences file for Feeder. So I could copy that over from my Carbon Copy Cloner backup into the same location in my home folder on my new fresh install of macOS Mojave. So I copied that. I copied the application support folder for Feeder, which has all of the RSS feeds and files and stuff like that. And so by manually moving those two over, when I launch Feeder on my new system, even though it's a clean, brand new downloaded copy of Feeder, it still has all of my information. All my windows are in the same place because the preferences are there, the application support files are there. So for individual applications, those are the two locations that you're going to need to grab from your old backups and move to your new backups. So all in all, for me, it took about a day or two to get most of the basic functionality of my system back. And so far, everything is working great. It's running very, very smoothly. I almost didn't even notice that anything has changed. And then once that was all set up and working, the kind of last step that I go through in a clean install is to start to reset up my backup schedule and my backups and stuff like that. So I did reconnect Backblaze and restored my Backblaze, just basically transferred my Backblaze backups. So my online backup was back up and running. I also reconnected my Time Machine backup and had it pick up where it left off and connected it to my new macOS Mojave install. I'm going to, and I haven't quite yet because it's only been a few days, reset up my ChronoSync. And I will use the technique of moving the application support folder in the preferences file so it gets all my configurations, because I want all of that to be set up exactly the same way it was on my old system. So I'll move that over in the next couple days. The one exception for backups that I hold off on when I do a clean install and don't reset up is my cloned backup. Because, again, I'm still going to have two backups, an on-site with my Time Machine and an off-site with my Backblaze plus my archiving. So I feel like I'm comfortable with the backups I have of my new Mojave system, but what I'm not certain about is, are there any applications that I'm missing, or any preference files or any application support files that maybe I still need from my old macOS Sierra system? So I hold on to my cloned backup for about 2 months or so. So once I've been using my machine for about 2 months, I'll feel pretty comfortable that there's nothing on the old system that I'm missing anymore, that everything got transferred over, right? There's this sort of period I go through of like, you know, is everything working the way it should be? Because there's a few applications that I don't open that frequently. And even before I, you know, then go, okay, it's safe to reset up my clone backup, I will go through my applications folder in my old system on that cloned backup and just go one by one, look at all the applications, compare that to what's on my new system, and make sure that I did migrate everything over. And once I'm confident in that, then I will go reset up my cloned backup. If that makes you uncomfortable, not having a cloned backup for a month or two while you're transitioning, you know, hard drives are pretty cheap, external hard drives. I may even go out sometimes and just buy a new external hard drive to start up a brand new cloned external backup. But, you know, for now, for me, I think I'm going to be fine just sitting with this extra backup. And that's it. That's how I go through a clean install. As far as how I'm feeling about macOS Mojave, I love it. But honestly, I have to say, nothing's been very life-changing in this upgrade. I would have thought, you know, having skipped a whole year, missing out on High Sierra, that I'd be looking forward to a bunch of new features. For me, day-to-day, not much has really changed. It doesn't feel like a different operating system to me, and maybe that's sad to say. I don't know. It's good for me in a lot of ways because it's very comfortable. There's a few nice things like Stacks. You know, I kind of like Stacks, and, you know, is it life-changing, though? No, it's cleaned up my desktop a little bit, but I generally keep a pretty clean desktop anyway. I'm just trying to think of any killer new features that I've really noticed that I'm going, yeah, that's something that I love. There's a lot of niceties, and we're going to talk about a few of those in a second. But yeah, that's what I'm really enjoying about macOS Mojave. The one thing that I'm not enjoying, I actually hate at this point, is, you know, and this, a lot of this comes from installing a bunch of new applications from scratch, every application having to ask for permissions. I get that this is a big part of Apple's security and privacy thing, but man, oh man, and if you've upgraded to macOS Mojave, you know what I'm talking about. Every application, you've got to open up system preferences. You've got to go into security and privacy. You've got to allow it to access different levels of the operating system in order to function. And this is for a lot of applications and utilities that you're installing. And it is annoying to the point where I'm kind of feeling like it's doing a disservice, because I think a lot of people are going to get into that click OK mode, yeah, stop bothering me, and not read through and try and discover what permissions these applications are asking for. You're just saying yes to everything blindly because you just get tired of so many pop-up dialogues. So I'm feeling like with Mojave, Apple's fallen to the bad side of that balance, and it might be a problem. So I'm hoping that's something they address or maybe can clean up in the future. So I'm not liking that part of Mojave, but I am absolutely loving everything else. Again, it doesn't feel all that different, but it's nice to be finally on the latest version of the operating system. So I do want to get into some of the new features that people are excited about. I'm not saying I'm ignoring them. I've been playing around with some of them. I have a couple of favorites, or I don't even know if I'd call them favorites. I have a couple of ones that I think are neat. Like, they're really cool features. And then one that a lot of people are excited about, and I get that they're excited about, but personally, not so much. I'm not excited about it. So let's start with that one. It's dark mode. I know a lot of you really, really love dark mode. I'm trying to understand and like it. It's funny because I'm a software developer, and a lot of software development tools are in dark mode. As a matter of fact, if I'm being honest, I use Sublime Text for my code editing, and I do use a darker theme for that. Not a pitch black, black on white theme, but I do use a dark gray theme for that, and it seems to work okay for code. Where I don't like dark mode and where it bugs me is with reading, and for things like the MacCast, you know, I'm doing show notes and stuff in a text editor. I'm working a lot in text editors, and I just think that reading white text on a black background is very hard on my eyes. I just don't enjoy it. So I tried flipping on dark mode. It lasted, honestly, for about 30 seconds, and I thought I was going to die. I just did not like it at all. So for me, it doesn't personally do much. We're also in a weird transition period where, you know, a lot of apps are updating themselves to support it, but there's still a lot of apps that don't. So we're in this weird hybrid period where if you turn it on, some things look good, and then some things don't look so good because they're not fully supporting it. So I think once that's sorted out, it's going to be a great, nice feature. I love that it's an option. A lot of people say, oh, you should try the thing where it automatically darkens, you know, between day and night. So during the day, it's light theme, and during the night, it's a dark theme. And that's a cool little trick and everything like that. But no, I just don't like dark mode. It's just not something for me. But if you love it, awesome. I think it's great to have the choice. And for those of you who don't know that what we're talking about, if you go into, if you're running macOS Mojave and you go into System Preferences, into General, right at the top, there is an appearance option, and you can pick light appearance or dark appearance, and the dark appearance is dark mode. So you can switch that over, and there is a way to set that to sort of transition automatically too, if you'd like to do that. But yeah, not really something that I'm very much into. A feature that I do think is really cool, though, is Continuity Camera. And if you don't know what Continuity Camera is, this is something, if you have a device running iOS 12 and you have a Mac that supports Continuity, which is, I think, most Macs made from 2012 on. So if you have a 2012 or newer Mac, it should be supporting Continuity. And your Mac is running macOS Mojave. This is a new Mojave feature. And in order to use it, you do have to have your Mac and your iOS device both with Wi-Fi and Bluetooth turned on. It uses both those technologies to communicate. And your Mac and iOS devices need to be signed into the same iCloud account. And this is really important, with the same Apple ID. And you need to have two-factor authentication enabled. So yes, there's a lot of caveats to get this feature to work, but it's really worth it because when you see it in action, it's a really cool thing. And that Apple ID, again, very important. This is a general, let me give you a general troubleshooting tip for anything with iCloud. If you've been around for a long time like me, you have an Apple ID or an iCloud account where you have an at mac.com, at me.com, and at iCloud.com email address or account ID, and they all work, right? You can use any one of those things. But when you're signing into iCloud with that Apple ID, you want to make sure you're consistent about which one you use, and always use the same one. Because I have seen weird things where I'm logged into, you know, my account at iCloud.com on one device and my account at me.com on another device, and then syncing, and these features don't work. You need to verify that you're always using the same email address across all your devices. It's really important. It doesn't always matter, but just for consistency and making sure you don't run into problems, I highly recommend that you do that. So for Continuity Camera, make sure you're logged into iCloud with the same Apple ID across all of your accounts, across all of your devices. And then this should work for you. And this feature works inside the Finder, inside Notes, Mail, Messages, Text Edit, and the latest versions of Pages, Keynote, and Numbers. I don't know if the feature is available to third-party apps. It might be. But what it allows you to do is to use the camera on your iOS device to take a picture or scan a document right directly into any one of these applications immediately. And it is really cool. So what you do is, in a supported app, once you've enabled all this, you control click in the window or right click in the window, and in the contextual menu, there's an option for import or insert from iPhone or iPad. And then under that menu, you'll have the option to take a photo or to scan a document. And when you pick that, Continuity Camera will kick in. It will open the camera app into the right mode on your iOS device. And then you can take a picture or scan a document. If you take a picture, you just snap a picture like you normally would, that photo will be imported right into the document on your Mac. if you've chosen to scan a document, it will go into the scanning mode. It will create a PDF for you, and you can even do a multi-page PDF. So you take a picture, it will add the skew correction and image enhancement adjustments to give you the best scan, and then you can take another image, and then when you tap done, all of those will be thrown into a PDF document and, again, inserted or put right into whatever application you started from. So this is really handy if you just need to quickly scan some documents into a folder on your Mac. You can use this feature to do that. Then you can open up those documents on your Mac. You can use the markup tools to mark it up, add a signature, do whatever you might want to do. And, you know, it works great. It is really, really cool. If you haven't played around with it, check out Continuity Camera. Probably one of my favorite new features in Mojave. How much am I going to really use it on a day-to-day basis? Not that much, but when I need it and it's there, yeah, that's going to be pretty, pretty awesome. The last kind of new feature that I want to talk to you about is similar to this. It's a little enhancement to screenshots. So you may or may not know how to take a screenshot on your Mac. If you do Command-Shift-3 on your keyboard, that takes a screenshot of your entire screen. If you have multiple displays, it'll do both screens, and it will put those images on your desktop. If you want to be more selective about it, you might know that you can do Command-Shift-4, and that will allow you to draw a selection around an area of your screen that you want to take a screenshot of. If you are in that mode and then you tap the space bar, it will let you take a screenshot of a single window or a single drop-down pane or whatever it might be. You can move your cursor around and it will highlight the thing that it's going to take a screenshot of. You know, like if you just want a screenshot of your dock, you can do that. So those have been with us for a long time. It's a cool way to take a screenshot. With macOS Mojave, they now have a version with a heads-up display, a little bit of an interactive screenshot option. So now, if you press Command-Shift-5, you'll get a little toolbar, a screenshot toolbar across the bottom there, and you'll get those options for a full screenshot, for a selection, or a window. And then there's also a little options menu, and under the options menu, you can choose the location that you want that screenshot to go to. So by default, if you use the other two methods, it just goes to your desktop. You get a little screenshot on your desktop. With the options under Command-Shift-5, you can choose to save to your desktop, to your documents folder, directly to the clipboard, directly to mail, messages, or preview. Or if you choose other, you can pick any other folder on your Mac to save that screenshot directly into. Also under that options menu, they give you some timer options. I believe in the other screenshot methods, you can activate the timer options by holding down modifier keys, either option or shift. I don't remember off the top of my head. But in here, you can simply pick it from a menu. And you also have options for showing the cursor or hiding the floating thumbnail. And what the floating thumbnail is this is the new feature of screenshots. When you take a screenshot, it will at first appear in a little picture-in-picture window on your Mac, and you can tap on that to open up the markup tools if you want to mark up that document, or if you just leave it alone, it will go away and just save that to your desktop, and you don't have to mess with it. If you don't want to see that at all, so say you're taking a screenshot and you just want it to go right into a folder, you can turn on the hide floating thumbnail option when you do Command-Shift-5, and then it'll just go there straight. You won't have to see that thumbnail. So the nice thing about the thumbnail is you can open up that thumbnail. You can modify the image, use the sharing options to maybe send it in a text message, and then tap the delete button when you're done, and then you don't have to save a copy of that screenshot onto your Mac. So the floating window is kind of handy. You can do a similar thing on iOS. If you've been using screenshots in iOS 12, you are familiar with kind of how that interface works. But a great new little interactive screenshot option in macOS Mojave, another really cool feature. Those are some of the ones that I've been playing around with and that I think are pretty cool. I'm sure there's some others that I'm missing. And even if you have tips for me from macOS High Sierra, because I didn't upgrade to High Sierra, send those in. So send me your Mojave tips and things that you're liking about Mojave and your, any other things you think I should know about. And I'll check those out and maybe share some of them on a future episode of MacCast. So send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. We've been talking a little bit on the MacCast about two-factor authentication. I think we went through some issues on a recent episode of the MacCast that somebody was having. And this week, I got a little bit of a related question from listener Graham. So here's what he was asking about. And this specifically deals with two-factor authentication when you're sharing accounts.
Hello, Adam. Listener Graham here from Portland, Oregon. I'm a big fan of two-factor authentication, and I've been trying to implement it on all the accounts that I have, but unfortunately, I've run into a bit of a problem that I'm hoping you can help me with. A lot of the accounts that I use are not ones that I use alone. Oftentimes, other members of my family will be logging onto that same account. If I sign up for two-factor authentication on accounts that my family use, they're going to get locked out because the two-factor authentication code is going to be sent to my phone and not their phone. Now, if I'm in the house, that's not a problem. I can just tell them what it is. But oftentimes, I'm away. So I know that Google Authenticator and software services like 1Password can be used with two-factor authentication. Is there a way that families can use two-factor authentication despite the fact that they have individual phone numbers? Can the authentication code be generated despite the fact that multiple people are using the same account? Thanks again for your help on this. I've been a listener since the beginning, and I find your podcast absolutely invaluable. Thanks.
Hey, thanks, Graham. Thanks for being a longtime listener. I really, really do appreciate that. And your question is a great one. It's actually something I've had to deal with as well, because I use two-factor authentication on a number of my accounts, and I do share some of those accounts with members of my family. I don't know. This question is a little hard for me to answer because I don't know universally that there is a single answer. Because, again, two-factor authentication is implemented in many different ways on many different services. And so in some cases, the answer I give you might be, you know, might work for one service, but maybe doesn't work for another service. And specifically, I'm thinking about those services where you get a text with the two-factor code, you know, via like an SMS message. And for that, there, as you kind of noted, there isn't really a good solution because you're going to get the code to your phone number, and most services don't let you put in two different phone numbers to receive that code. I guess that would be one way they can handle it, but for now, the way I handle that is even if I'm not at home, I will get that text message, and if I see one of those come in, I can assume maybe that one of my family members is wanting that, so I just check with them on a text, hey, did you need a two-factor code? And then I just forward that text message to them or just pass that number to them in a text message. Yeah, it's a little clunky and cumbersome, but for the added security, I think it's important. You could even set up a group like family iMessage, so you could just send it to everyone in your family, regardless of whoever that might be. And even if someone was trying to spoof you, right, if it was not one of your family members trying to log in and somebody else, it's relatively benign to be emailing or texting that two-factor code to your family because they're just going to go, hey, we didn't need this, you know, and then you just ignore it. So that's just fine there. I think the other part of your question, though, is sort of related to Authenticator, you know, a tool like Google Authenticator or one of these code generators. And as a matter of fact, 1Password does have one of these built in. And so I don't know about other services that allow you to scan, you know, the two-factor QR code and sort of generate the code number. But I do know that if you have a 1Password account and you're using the 1Password family plan, then you can scan those QR codes in with your entry inside 1Password, and it will be sort of tied to that entry, and then you can get the two-factor code right out of the application. And with the 1Password family plan, you can put those accounts into different groups and share those with different members of your family. So in my case, I use the family plan, and I have certain groups that are set up for the entire family, so accounts that, you know, the whole family might need access to, say like Netflix, or then there's also accounts like our banking account, which maybe I only share with my wife, right? My kids don't need access to that. And if I have two-factor turned on and I've used the two-factor code inside 1Password, that code generation will sync across all devices that are sharing access to that password in 1Password. So that solves the problem immediately because my wife can just open up 1Password, click on the one-time code, and she will have the code that she needs generated right out of the 1Password application. And even cooler, now because 1Password can integrate with iOS 12 and its password functionality and the Mac, when you're logging into a website that uses two-factor authentication with a code generated out of 1Password, it can actually auto-generate and auto-copy that code right to the clipboard. So when you get to that screen that says enter the code, you don't even have to go, you know, into the app and generate it. It's already on your clipboard. You just paste it right in, and boom, you're right into that application. So I think that's one of the best ways to do it, is use the family plan with a service like 1Password. I don't know if this functionality is available in other services like LastPass or KeePass or, you know, some of those other services, but I would imagine that it might be, and that could be a solution for you. You know, beyond that, you know, I don't know any other workarounds other than, again, you know, texting, or your family member might have to call you and say, hey, can you give me that code that was just generated? Yep, not as convenient, but I think it's important for the added security that two-factor authentication brings. Another quick comment on the SMS thing. There's kind of a big push in the security community to get rid of SMS as a method for two-factor authentication codes and only use a code generation application because it's much more secure. With SMS or email or something like that, those messages could potentially be intercepted and they're not encrypted in general. So it's a little bit of a security risk. You can get a man in the middle where they might, you know, grab that message before it ever gets to you or something like that. So that's a concern and maybe something that will get addressed or rectified at some point. But great question, and thanks for that. Now, interestingly, Graham was not the only person with some concerns or some issues with two-factor authentication. I also this week received this voicemail from Mike, who ran into a little bit of a problem when he was setting up a new phone and just wanted to give us all a little bit of advice. So here's what Mike had to say.
Hi, Adam. This is Mike from Hershey, Pennsylvania. I was listening to your September 23rd podcast, another great podcast, and I was listening to your two-factor authentication part. And just a quick story, I had upgraded to the iPhone XS Max on Friday, and I learned a valuable lesson with the two-factor authentication because I just turned it on a short time ago. And I backed up my old phone to the cloud, and then I wiped it, did the reset, and then started on uploading and getting the new XS Max ready to go. Unfortunately, it was asking me for a code that was being sent to my phone. Unfortunately, my phone, I had wiped, and I had no way to get a code. I don't have my accounts live on other devices of mine because we have an iPad and a MacBook, but those are family items that a lot of us use, so I don't have my messages, my text messages going to those devices. So I had no way to get the code to get through my phone setup. Called AppleCare. And unfortunately, they said there was nothing they could do. I had to go into an account recovery where it could take up to a week to hear back from Apple. It's been 4 days now, 3 days. I still haven't heard from them. Fortunately, what I was able to do was basically create a new Apple ID for my account. That allowed me to set up my phone, and my text messages finally appeared. I was able to get the code to unlock the two-factor authentication. So just kind of a warning, if anyone has that, either have different items, computers that have the your text messages, or don't do two-factor authentication if you're worried about that. It was just a scary thing because I still haven't heard back from Apple, but thankfully I was able to get everything set up. So I don't understand why Apple doesn't have a backup, like allowing you to check an email address or another phone if you needed to, because I know other companies like Google allow you to do that. So, again, thanks, Adam. Great podcast. Take care.
Hey, Mike. Yeah, that sounds like it would have been a little bit frustrating, especially when you're trying to set up a new device. Obviously, the tip or the bit of advice there is when you're setting up a new device, set up the new device first before you erase the old device. And I know that doesn't help you at this point, but I'm glad that you sorted it out. The one thing I was thinking about as you were making your comment is you might have been able to take the SIM card from your old phone, put it in your new phone, and then during the setup wizard, just skip the part where you're trying to set up your iCloud account, and that should allow you to get into your phone, and it should still set it itself up on your cellular data network, and then that would allow you to still receive the text message, because when you're trying to log into iCloud, it'll try to send the push notification, but then if you don't receive that, I believe there's a link or an option to use another method, and as long as on your account you had set up a trusted device phone number, and I'm assuming that's how you were getting the text message, you should still be able to receive that text message. Now, going back to what I was just commenting about earlier, though, that's a little bit of a security risk. I'm not convinced that Apple should have SMS or a text message as a backup option, because that could potentially be an attack vector for a hacker or someone like that trying to get into your account, you know, doing an SMS interception or a man-in-the-middle kind of attack sort of thing. That was going to be my answer to you as to why Apple doesn't offer some sort of backup. I also read on Apple's website related to two-factor authentication that you should be able to get that that number not only as a text message, you know, the login from the backup trusted number, not only as a text message, but also as a phone call, although I couldn't figure out how to trigger that. I tried to go on my iCloud account and see if I could get in and have it actually call me on the phone with a number, but I couldn't get it to do that. So that might have been another way that you could get into that. But I'll also just, you know, make the argument as to why you wouldn't want to erase your old device when you're setting up a new device anyway on iOS. And that's because with the NFC, there's a new feature where you can take your old phone and you can put it near your new phone and will automatically transfer over a lot of your account settings and stuff like that. I did this the last two times I set up my iPhone. So I did my backup to iCloud, got my new device, and then I put my new device near my old device and boom, it copied everything over and started setting up, and I was able to save a lot of steps in that wizard. So I would just say in the future, you know, set up the new device before you erase the old one. And then once everything's transferred over and you're good to go, you can go ahead and set it up that way. So there you have it. A couple of little two-factor authentication things, a little bit of follow-up to the last episode of the MacCast. Now we have a little Apple Watch bit of advice, buying advice, I guess, really. If you are looking at Apple's charging stand for the Apple Watch and you have a new Series 4 Apple Watch, here's what John ran into.
Hey, Adam, this is John Davis from the Nashville area. First of all, I really enjoy your podcast. I've been listening for a while, so thanks for doing all that. I'm calling today because I ordered a magnetic charging stand from Apple in preparation for getting the Series 4 watch, which I have received, and I love it, number one. So anyway, what I've discovered with that charger is that I believe when I first set it on the charger in the upright position, and you know the charger I'm speaking of, the white one that's a circle with a magnetic circle in the middle and you can flip it up. When I put the watch on its side for the first time at night, one or two in the morning, it started flashing, going on and off and trying to reconnect to that charging circle, I think, because I was seeing the charging ring and then the watch would come on and then it would go off and come back on. Drove me nuts, honestly. But what I think I've discovered, and I am returning it, I was right at the 30-day cusp and Apple made an exception to the 14-day, which I really appreciated their flexibility on it. I am returning it. What I've discovered is when you lay the watch flat on that little magnetic charging deal, it works just fine. I've tested it several nights. I've changed cables. You know, done all the troubleshooting that I could with the charger. There's not too much to change. But laying it flat on the charger at night is just fine. However, of course, you can't see the watch unless you stand up, which when you're in bed, that's not a very convenient thing to do. So what I believe is the extra size of the 44 millimeter Series 4 is causing that magnet charger piece not to exactly line up with the watch and stay connected when it's in the upright position. And I tested this with my wife's Series 3, and hers works just fine on that same charger. Never flashes in the night. So that's just a tip I thought I would pass along. I think at some point Apple's going to have to address that, because people buy that charger, and it's not the least expensive charger out there, hoping that they can use it, or thinking they can use it, in the upright or in the lay down position. And right now the only way I could get it to work was in the laying down position, which told me the charger was functioning fine, the cable was okay, but I believe that 44 millimeter watch is just a little bit too big and it doesn't quite line up. So anyway, there's the tip for you, and maybe you could share that with your listeners. And once again, thanks for everything that you do, Adam. Bye.
You're welcome. And yes, very happy to share this with the listeners, because it's a little bit of a buying advice. And I actually went on Apple's website to check this out, to see what they were saying in terms of the compatibility. And sure enough, they say it is compatible. That current, you know, I call it the donut charger, right? It's the Apple branded round wireless charger with the little flip up disc in the middle, so that you can use it in the nightstand mode, which is, I'm assuming, what you were trying to do. And they say it's compatible with Apple Watch Series 4, yet in looking at the image, I can see the way that that flips up and the hinge that it's on, there's not a lot of tolerance down there at the bottom. So I'm guessing you're right that in the full vertical position, the 44 millimeter watch might just be just large enough that it hits that bottom base and sort of slides up just ever so slightly out of the magnetic sort of, you know, because that thing magnets into place, slides up ever so slightly out of alignment just enough with the charging coil that it gets a little bit unreliable. So I could see that possibly happening. I'm curious if anybody else has run into this. I did wonder, John, as I was looking at that design and looking how it worked, if you maybe tilted it back slightly so that disc wasn't fully vertical, but maybe just, you know, back at maybe a 15 degree angle instead of 90, so back to, I don't know, 75, something like that, 80 degrees, if that would give it just enough clearance to stay connected. Another thing that I thought that might be the issue was weight. You know, I immediately went and checked the specs to see, is the 44 millimeter significantly heavier than the 42? So maybe it's just sliding down, you know, because of the weight of it, just not being the magnet not being strong enough to hold it to the charger. And lo and behold, to my surprise, I found out that the 44 millimeter might even be slightly, weigh slightly less than the Series 3 42 millimeter. So that could be a difference there. But, you know, I think this is an important thing for people to note, because this may be a problem with some third-party stands as well. So if you're in the market with your Series 4 for a new stand and it has some sort of tight tolerance around where the watch is, remember that the new watch is slightly larger at 44 millimeters, that could cause a problem with some charging stands. So thanks for sending that in and giving everybody that little bit of buying advice. There was one other Apple Watch thing that came up this week. This came from listener Kevin, and it was related to the animated emojis that we used to have. I thought these were originally part of the Digital Touch. They came out at the same time that Apple introduced Digital Touch, but it turns out they're actually like stickers or emojis. You may remember it's the hands and the different hearts and the smileys, and you could bring them up on the Apple Watch, and then you could rotate the digital crown and go through the different styles so the faces would change and you could pick the face that you wanted. Or you had different hearts, including the ability to change the color of the hearts. There was like purple ones and red ones and stuff like that. Apparently, those are not available in Apple Watch OS 5. And Kevin noted that. The closest you can get to accessing them now is in the stickers section on the Apple Watch. So if you're in Messages and you tap on the emoji icon and you scroll down, at the very bottom there's a stickers option. But unfortunately, inside stickers, all you can access is the four most recent stickers that you've used in Messages. So if you want to be able to access the smileys or the hearts or the hands, you will have to have recently used those in a message to be able to access them. And not only that, it doesn't feel like all of the versions are there anymore. And you do need to have the sticker packs, the Apple sticker packs for hands, hearts, and smileys installed in your chat application, in your messages application. So these don't appear to be there anymore in watchOS 5, something that went away. I didn't notice, but listener Kevin did. As to why Apple has removed that functionality, my guess is that they feel like Animoji and Memoji sort of replaces that. I think it's kind of not quite the same, but I was trying to fathom why Apple got rid of that feature. Maybe just enough people didn't use it, or they just felt like stickers was a way to deal with that. But even there, you know, you used to be able to go into the emoji and you could swipe through multiple pages. Now they're divided into kind of categories, and for some reason the stickers, you have limited access to the stickers, at least from your Apple Watch. So if you do want to use those stickers and have access to the full complement, you're going to have to, you know, grab your iPhone out of your pocket and use it from your iPhone. So just another little Apple Watch thing, a couple little Apple Watch things there to talk about this week. All right, last thing that I have for you this week is a comment from listener Steven. He was looking at iCloud messages, or messages in the cloud, I think Apple calls it, the new feature in iOS 12 that and also macOS Mojave that allows you to sync your messages between your devices. So if you delete messages on one device, they delete across all of your devices. Well, he ran into a little bit of a dilemma with that, and here's what he had to say.
Hey, Adam, this is Steve. I have a conversation I'd like to have about iMessage in the cloud, and the issue of deleting messages. The way it stands now with the latest version of iOS and Mojave, we have lost the ability to close a message conversation without deleting it. There is no more archiving of a message, even though there's still a setting inside of the messages preference on both platforms to keep messages forever. It's unclear as to what that actually means in regards to if those come back, messages do reappear if somebody re-engages you in a conversation after you've deleted. But I think the biggest issue is that because swiping or hitting delete is such a destructive process across all your devices and there is no undo, I think it would be nice if there was a forced prompt with your Apple ID password to, you know, let you know something so destructive is going to take place. Or implement a trash can folder like, Photos has, or even the recording app has a recently deleted folder for long conversations that you have with people. You don't necessarily talk to them all that often, but it's nice to follow up and see what you last chatted about and not always just permanently delete every message. It would be like deleting a single email message would retroactively and recursively delete every email that you sent or received from that person. I don't think messages are or should be so transient in that respect. Even Facebook has an archive feature for conversations. So I would be afraid to have a phone let loose in a toddler's hand if it would mean that it deleted every photo and conversation you had exchanged with somebody. So I would like to hear your thoughts and your take on this information. I've sent Apple several bug reports regarding this during the beta period. Haven't heard anything. And now that Mojave's out, it's actually even more poignant because it's 100% now parody where it's always delete, no archive. Thanks.
Hey, Steven. I think this is a great conversation to have as well. I think I need to sort of maybe break it into two things. And one of the things that after I received this audio comment from Steven, I emailed him about was a couple of follow-up questions, because I wasn't really sure, Stephen, as you know from the email I sent you, I wasn't sure what the issue was. Was this the fact that you can accidentally delete an entire conversation thread and have no way to get things back? Or is this more about wanting to have an archive feature where I want a place where I can sort of stash messages away that I choose to keep forever and not really see them in my full list? Because to answer that sort of first question, you know, why, what does keep forever mean? That, I think, now under the new messages, you know, iCloud messages or messages in the cloud, that still means what it always meant, which is if I have a message thread going and I leave it in messages, the individual messages inside that message thread, am I going to keep all of them forever? Am I going to keep the last 60 days? Am I going to keep just a year? And anything that falls outside that window gets deleted out of that thread. But the thread itself still exists as long as I keep that thread around. What has changed, if I'm getting this right and understanding, because I've seen this happen before too, is in the past, before we had messages in the cloud, you could, you know, close, you could quote unquote delete a conversation or a message thread. And then if that person texted you again or sent you a message again, magically that whole thread would sort of come back. But what I can't remember is if that was only per device, because I think messages, depending upon where you read them, were only on a single device. I think a lot of this is confusing, and maybe this is where a lot of this is coming from. So where I want to kind of break this conversation down into is, one, is it too easy to accidentally delete a conversation? Really these two things, right? Is it too easy to accidentally delete a conversation? Has Apple screwed up the application in a way that is detrimental to users with the features of messages in the cloud? And then two, do we need to have some sort of archive option, like an extra option that's different than delete, where we can kind of keep these messages around? And, you know, or I think we need, both need to be addressed. But I think one of the questions is did Apple screw up? Is there something inherently broken now with messages that doesn't make sense? Or, you know, is that okay? And then two, what other features should we have related to messages? And, you know, as I'm thinking about this, it really comes down to how you think about messages. Now, you say messages shouldn't be transient, but I think that originally was the whole point of messages, right? If you wanted something that wasn't transient, you used email, and messages really were kind of meant to be this transient thing. Now, you can argue, and I think rightfully so, that this has dramatically changed in recent years. I think more people are using messaging apps than they are using email. So maybe we do need to be thinking about messaging more a little bit like email. And I also got a little bit more perspective because I did email Steven and got a little more clarity of what happened to him. Because I mentioned back, well, you know, there is a warning dialog that prompts you when you go to delete a message thread, and it says, would you like to delete this conversation? This conversation will be deleted from all of your devices. So it doesn't just immediately, you know, you swipe left and you tap delete and it immediately deletes everything. It does give you a warning, and if you proceed, then yes, that message thread is gone. Now, the difference is in the past, I think, like Stephen was alluding to, if you start up a conversation again with that person or retext them, those messages sort of magically came back. And I would almost argue that that was a little bit confusing because you would be like, I thought I deleted this thread. And maybe for even security or privacy reasons, you did literally mean to delete it, yet here are all those messages again. So I would maybe argue that Apple was trying to rectify something that was, in their mind, already confusing. I don't know. I don't want to put thoughts into the engineers' heads. But you can see where that might be coming from. But then Stephen did sort of provide some clarity that I think adds more information to this conversation, which is he was on a plane. He was trying to send an image to a message thread that he was involved with a person, and it had a pretty significant history, like a year's worth of history. Because of the slow connection on the plane, that image was taking forever. He decided to bail on it. And then because there is a confusing UI, and I will grant you this with the, in the case of messages, there is a very confusing UI. Instead of just deleting and canceling that one image text, he ended up deleting the whole conversation. And because of iCloud message syncing, he lost that entire history. And yes, that's absolutely devastating. That's awful, Stephen. I'm very sorry that that happened to you. Now, luckily, he was able to recover from a backup that he had on his Mac from a few days before, so he was able to get those messages back. So that was good news to hear. But yeah, you wouldn't want to lose that sort of history, especially like if you have a bunch of images and things like that in that maybe you wanted to save. But that brings up some other conversations that maybe we need to save for another MacCast, which is, you know, what's the responsibility for backing up messages and photos that are in messages? Because I know, you know, like in the case of my kids, they use message threads with images from friends and stuff like that, almost like a photo library. And, you know, they would be devastated if they lost all those. I've often told them, you need to save those into your photo library, because that gets backed up to your Mac and synced and all that stuff. But, you know, that often falls on deaf ears. But so getting back to this whole messaging conversation thing, I totally understand your point here. There is a possible risk of significant data loss if you delete a message thread, if people don't fully understand this feature, and maybe Apple hasn't done a good job of doing that. And yes, you're absolutely right. There's kind of a simple fix, right? It's taking that approach that Apple takes with your photo library or with mail or something like that, or even the Finder, where you delete something, quote unquote delete, it moves it to a temporary location, a trash folder, and then that sits there. And then you, if you really want to delete it immediately, you can go into that location and remove it or empty it, and then you're fully understanding, yes, this is going to be gone for forever. This message thread will be gone for forever. And that would be a great fix. Now, for whatever reason, they didn't choose to implement it that way. I also want to bring up the fact that you're right about the current interface. If I go into a message thread that I have going with someone, and I want to delete that thread, in the list, I can swipe to the left and there is a delete button, and that is going to delete the whole thread. If I want to delete an individual message, what I'm supposed to do is go in that message thread and then tap and hold. This is one of my issues with hidden interfaces, right? I've got to tap and hold on the message that I want to delete, right? And then a little dialog pops up and it says sticker details or more. I can tap on more at this point, and then I get an interface with checkboxes down the left. I can check off individual messages that I want, and then there is a trash can icon at the bottom. If I hit that trash can icon, it actually deletes that message, doesn't move it to any kind of trash can. It actually is going to delete it. Now, there is a confirmation dialog that comes up. I have to tap delete message, and then it deletes that message. But in that same interface, when I'm checking those off, there is also at the top a button that says delete all. And if I were to accidentally tap that button, it brings up a dialog and it says delete conversation. And it, despite the fact that I might only have a single message checked, it will delete the entire conversation. So that UI may be a little bit confusing. Again, I think in this day and age, we also have to take some responsibility on ourselves in the fact that a lot of people don't read pop-up dialogues or don't read them completely. And you're moving through stuff quickly and there's possibilities for accidents, which brings you back to your, I think, original argument, which is, you know, there should be some sort of extra check or some sort of interstitial, like a trash folder, that can protect people from themselves. And I don't entirely disagree with you. Now, there were some other suggestions Stephen had related to this topic in the email. He says, if you remove an entire message transcript, maybe there should be an ability to, or an extra check to reauthorize, you know, enter the password for your iCloud account to just confirm, yes, you're agreeing that you're going to delete this forever and for always. Yeah, maybe that's a good thing. Clarity as to what keeping messages forever means in the settings. I think I kind of already addressed that a little bit. I think that's okay. I don't have a problem with that. That's, you know, in the conversation thread, how long are you going to keep messages that are in the conversation thread? If you delete the thread, obviously that doesn't mean keeping it forever because you told it to delete the thread. So I'm not so convinced that there needs to be a change there. Swiping left on a message from the message list should not only have delete in the transcript. It shouldn't delete it from all devices. Maybe offer an archive option. I think it would be nice if there was an archive option, you know, like email. So maybe you don't need a trash folder. Maybe what we need is an archive option to unclutter the messages interface, because you can build up messages over the years. I think, you know, from Apple's perspective, the philosophy is if you want message threads to live forever, you just leave them forever in the messages application. I can see how for people who do a lot of messages, myself included, that gets really cluttered up and it starts to be hard to find things. There's not a lot of organization. Again, I don't think messages was ever approached from the point of working like email, but maybe that process does need to be rethought. And then one of your last arguments, I think, Stephen, was this toddler effect that you're talking about. You know, what happens if I give my iPhone to a toddler and they accidentally delete my messages? And, you know, I don't want to be dismissive of this, but I think if I had that concern personally, then I probably wouldn't be sharing my phone with a toddler. I get parents have toddlers and they use iPhones as entertainment, and you might give it to a younger child and, you know, you run the risk if you're doing that, if something like this happens. But I also run the risk of them, you know, deleting my email accounts or deleting all my emails. And yes, maybe there's ways to get that back, and we have backups for these reasons and stuff like that. I mean, there's just, I think that's a scenario that you can't build in every sort of protection for, right? Giving your kid to a child, who knows what's going to happen. But if you are going to do something like that, you know, Apple has provided a tool to help protect you, and that is in accessibility. There's a thing called guided access. So kind of a side detour tip right here. If you're a parent or someone and you're concerned about handing your phone over to a child, you can turn on guided access. And with guided access, you can lock the device into a single application, like literally get rid of the ability to go to the home screen. So if you go into settings, general accessibility, scroll to guided access and turn that on. You can even activate it with a triple click of the side button. So you can use that to activate and deactivate it. So if you wanted to hand your phone to a toddler to play a game, you open up that game, you triple click the button, you activate guided access, then it will pop up. You can even define areas of the screen that are clickable. So these are the only places you can click. So if it's a simple application and there's only certain areas where the buttons are, you can even limit it to that. Or you can just make it so, hey, you can't get out of this application. It looks like now they also have the ability to set a time limit. So you could even say, you can use this application only for the next 20 minutes. And then I'm not sure what would happen at the end of that. I guess maybe the iPhone just closes up and you can't access it. And it puts a passcode on it. So you set a passcode for accessing and turning off the guided access, and then it goes into guided access mode, and your phone is totally protected. There's nothing anybody can do with that phone other than use that one single app. So as you might imagine, this has some great applications outside of just, you know, handing your phone to a toddler, but there is a little bit of a protection for that already built into the system, and it's a little bit more universal. Maybe not exactly what you're going for, but you get my point, right? So for now, you know, I think if this accidental deletion or inability to get back to a message archive, or sort of the inability to archive messages, is a problem, I would recommend don't turn on messages in the cloud. Yes, you lose the ability to sort of sync your messages across devices, but we didn't have that in iOS 11. So you can kind of go back and have the world back in iOS 11 days, maybe until Apple sort of addresses some of these problems, if they are problems. And I guess that's the conversation we really should have, and maybe ultimately the thing you were trying to open up, Stephen, and I thank you for your email because of this, because I hadn't been thinking about these things. To me, it didn't seem like a big deal, but you've opened my eyes to, hey, this could be a problem for some people. Obviously, it's a problem for you. It's something that is concerning to you, and I appreciate those concerns. So we probably should talk about this a little bit. So, you know, what do you guys think? What is this a problem? Has Apple created an issue with some of the changes they've made here with messages and not having the ability to sort of have an archive? I definitely would like the ability to archive some of these messages and not delete them, because I'm in agreement with you, Steve. You know, I want to keep some of these around, but I don't want to have them all in the list. And so now I feel like I'm forced to keep everything in my messages for forever. And that's just a lot of data to have sort of in front of me every time I open up the messages app. I'm a little bit of a neat freak in terms of my digital devices, and I like things neat and tidy. You know, like my desktop, I don't keep a bunch of icons on there. But one last thing I will point out, if you do want to turn on or keep messages in the cloud turned on and you're concerned about accidental deletion and keeping the history of all of your messages, there are tools out there. These guys have been a Maccast sponsor in the past. They're not currently a sponsor, but iMazing is a great application, and it gives you the ability to back up your messages locally to your Mac. So you can back up all of your message threads, and you can even recover and extract messages from your iTunes backups. So if you needed to get in, you know, you accidentally deleted a whole thread for a year or a couple years, as long as you have a backup on your Mac, either made through iTunes or through the iMazing app, you can get in and extract those. Or just set up iMazing, use it periodically to actually archive and back up all your messages and just keep a copy locally on your Mac. That then you could back it up to the cloud and back it up other places. So that might be another handy little tool for you. iMazing.com if you want to check that out. But thanks, Steve, for your email. And if you have any comments or you know, suggestions or recommendations on that, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the Maccast. Looks like we went a little bit longer than normal. It was a little bit longer between shows, so we got to play a little bit of catch-up. This happens from time to time. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors. That is Smile, makers of Text Expander. PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iOS, PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the Maccast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the Maccast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the Maccast, you can find those on the website. No, that's where you get the show notes. You can send me an email or an audio comment. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. Now we'll get to the show notes part. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the Maccast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/Maccast. You can check out the Maccast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMaccast, or check out the Maccast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/PlusMaccast. But that will do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.